Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. With summer right around the corner, some of you are probably already planning your beach vacations. And especially if you're headed somewhere like Cape Cod, that planning may include a whale watch. If you're lucky, you might even catch a glimpse of a North Atlantic right whale, one of the rarest species of whale on the planet. Now, you might remember we talked on Radio Boston last month about the delayed start of the lobstering season in Massachusetts. That was a result of efforts to protect the right whale that were seen off the Massachusetts coast. We wanted to learn a little bit more about these beautiful, rare creatures, so we reached out to Scott Krause. He's a vice president and senior research advisor at the New England Aquarium. He spent decades researching right whales, and while he's passionate about them, he admits that right whales look, well, a little bit weird.
Well, right whales are funny looking, to be perfectly blunt. They get to be about 50 feet in length, and at the front end, or the head of the animal, it looks like it's upside down. In fact, many early anatomists published pictures of whales that were upside down because it looks like they have a big smile, but the smile is in reverse. And they have growths on their head called callosities, which allows us to tell every individual apart. So it's like looking at their face. And then the rest of them is black and smooth. They're very rotund animals. They have beautiful, smooth-edged flukes that they raise almost every time they dive. So they're quite popular in places where you can go whale watching for them because they're beautiful on the back end.
So in Massachusetts, people hunted right whales for a long time. We have the Whaling Museum in New Bedford, of course, and they were hunted really to the brink of extinction, right, in the late 1800s. And then the population sort of began rebuilding. And then since 2010, it seems to be dwindling again. What's going on? We were making progress, and then it's reversed.
Yeah, that's true. Right whales have probably been growing from very near extinction in the 1930s or so up to almost 500 animals by 2010. The growth rate was extremely slow. It was about 2 to 3% per year, but at least it was growth. And then starting in 2010, we started seeing a decline in calf production and an increase in serious injuries and mortalities from ship strikes and entanglements. So, you know, it's basic math. You start killing more than you start producing, you start losing population size.
And so right whales, they're baleen whales, right? So they eat by sort of like straining the seawater through their baleen like a sieve.
And that's exactly right.
And so they gobble up, as I understand it, these tiny little crustaceans. And this is becoming a factor increasingly too, right, as we talk about climate change and the impact on the whale species. I think some of us are familiar with the threat of entanglements that you described or maybe ship strikes. But some of the latest research that we've been reading shows that these tiny little crustaceans that they eat on have been moving because of warming ocean waters, and that's perhaps affecting whale populations too. What do we know about that?
Yeah, we're just learning about that. It does seem that, you know, the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than any other body of water in the North Atlantic, and that certainly affects the bottom of the food chain. And the animals that right whales live on are a planktonic animal called Calanus finmarchicus. And Calanus actually goes through several molting stages, and its growth is dependent upon temperature. And so as temperatures warm, there's changes in the way they are brought into the Gulf of Maine and the way they grow up. And those changes mean that when right whales go to habitats that they used to think were big aggregations of Calanus, they might not be there now.
You know, these whales communicate with sound under the water, but that's harder when there's interference from, you know, ships and other sort of noise pollution. Can you fill in some details there?
Yeah, I mean, ships make a lot of low-frequency sound. Most of it's from cavitation. A little bit is from engine noise and just propeller noise. But most of it's from cavitation and propellers, which is inefficiency in the propeller. But what it does is it creates broadband, low-frequency sound that actually is occurring right in the same frequency that right whales use to communicate with one another. So one of my colleagues, Chris Clark, has estimated that the actual communication space, that is the distance over which an animal can hear and be heard, is diminished about 90% from the pre-industrial ocean.
Wow.
And so what that does is reduce the opportunities to communicate with one another, which may reduce opportunities to find mates, to find food, to keep track of your offspring, that kind of stuff. So ocean noise is a big deal. After 9/11, we shut down ports and airports on the East Coast for several days. And during that period of time, the ocean went quiet, probably quieter than it's been in 100 years. And during that time, while it was quiet, the cortisol levels in the right whales that we were sampling at the same time went down significantly. And there was a really big difference between that and all subsequent years. So it really does indicate that it's not trivial for these animals to live in an ocean that is full of noise all the time. And remember that in the case of shipping noise, these low-frequency sounds travel hundreds of miles. It doesn't disappear very quickly.
So how do we strike that balance between trying to create a healthier environment for the whales while also being mindful of people's business interests? I mean, so it's shipping, which we're talking about now. It's also, you know, the lobstering industry is a big one in Massachusetts. In fact, on our program just last month, we were talking with lobstermen who were frustrated by the delay to the beginning of their fishing season, which has happened a few times in recent years as state regulators try to protect right whales. I mean, this is sort of a longstanding tension. How do we find that balance?
I'll speak to the shipping piece first. One is that noise is generally a sign of fairly significant inefficiencies in whatever the machinery is. And when the airplane industry was actually criticized for creating all this noise around airports, the engineers set to work. They created quieter airplane engines, and it turned out that the economic value of those engines was paid off in spades because getting rid of the inefficiency made by noise actually increased the efficiency in terms of miles per gallon of airplane engines.
I see. But that's people complaining about sound pollution, and the whales can't complain in the
same
way.
You got a point. Yeah. They can't complain. On the other hand, if the cavitation is actually quite a problem for the shipping industry. It destroys propellers over time, and it's extremely it represents inefficiency in the propulsion system. So if you get rid of the noise from cavitation, all of a sudden you make propellers that are more efficient, and these guys will make more money. The shipping industry is fairly marginal. So that's actually a win-win both for the animals, for the oceans, and for the shipping industry. In the lobster case, it's a question of how we got here was largely due to the fact that everyone tends to think, well, if I'm fishing, you know, this kind of rope, if I could get a stronger rope that would last longer, that would be better for me. I'd make more money. And what has happened is that we have created ropes that are probably four or five times stronger than what's necessary for guys to get traps off the bottom. And I will say that the lobster industry has been some of our biggest partners in trying to solve this problem. They recognize that in the long term, none of them want to kill whales, and they recognize in the long term that the public doesn't want them to kill whales. So it's in their best interest to actually figure out how to collect lobsters for commercial purposes without killing animals. And the movement now is in the inshore fishery to go to back toward weaker rope that is more durable than it was, say, in the 50s when we were fishing with hemp, but weak enough so that whales can break free of it.
What would we lose if the right whale were to go extinct? I mean, I think a lot of folks want to save the whale just sort of on principle, like it's the right thing to do. But as a practical matter, I mean, what would the damage be to our ecosystem?
Well, I guess, I mean, this is an odd question because we have, many of us have this kind of intrinsic understanding that they're valuable. But in fact, it turns out that right whales and all whales do this very interesting ecosystem farming, if you want to call it that. They basically feed at depth on a variety of species, whether they're humpbacks feeding on herring or right whales feeding on calanus or sperm whales feeding on squid. All of these animals tend to feed at depth, and then they tend to defecate at the surface. And what that does is create a big nutrient pump. It brings nutrients and minerals and the stuff that happens at depth to the surface, which then filters out through the entire water column. First, it feeds phytoplankton, and then it feeds animal plankton, and then it goes on to feed commercial fisheries. And it's an indirect food chain activity that most people don't see or would not imagine. But the ecosystem value of right whales may be extremely valuable for commercial fisheries, and we should be paying attention to that. We're still in the early stages of understanding a lot of ocean ecosystem questions. But that's one that the link has been fairly consistently made.
So if individual listeners want to do their part, I mean, what can they do as the summer beach season comes up? You know, if you're going down the Cape, I mean, should you go on a whale watch, for example, or is that just contributing more to the noise pollution problem we were talking about?
I think whale watches are good, and I think that because people do get excited about seeing animals in the wild. There's this tremendous asymmetry between our understanding of conservation in the ocean and on land. On land, you say, well, we put up a national park, and that protects a big piece of real estate. In the ocean, you stand on the beach, and you look out on a sunny day, and you think, wow, everything's fine. There's no problem here. When you think about the animals in the ocean, it's good to think about that is their home. And if you were living there, if that were your home, what are the things that would matter to you? So, for example, we talk a lot about seismic exploration and how bad that could be for the environment. And so the analogy to that would be, imagine sitting in your nice home and somebody setting off a grenade in your front yard every 10 to 15 seconds for a year. That's the kind of impact that is happening in the ocean without us ever seeing it. You don't see it, you don't hear it. We don't have those capabilities. And so the same thing I would say applies to a variety of other activities in the ocean. It's good to think when we go into the ocean to do, whether it's aquaculture or wind farms or oil and gas drilling or whatever it is, what is it that we're doing that's affecting the homes of the animals that live there? And that includes everything from scallops and commercial fish all the way up to marine mammals and right whales.
That's Scott Krause. He's a vice president and senior science advisor at the New England Aquarium. Scott, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.